Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Performing surgery is an intense and stressful occupation, I can only imagine. It requires countless hours of training to become proficient, and getting trainees the time they need to learn can be a challenge. To solve this problem, a group of surgeons have developed a new app that allows anyone to learn and practice surgical procedures on an iPhone or iPad. The app is called Touch Surgery. Joining us now to discuss the app is Dr. John Namy. He is co-founder and CEO of Touch Surgery. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So what were the major concerns you had about teaching new surgeons that led you to create this app?
Well, there are several kind of issues that were being confronted with in Europe with surgical practice. Essentially, there were a reduction in hours. There were budget constraints and lots of impacts on service, and really getting into the operative room was very difficult and challenging for junior training surgeons. And getting that exposure that would make you a proficient and expert surgeon was just diminishing. And so we looked at teaching methods and looked at what the best way of learning was. And essentially, learning by doing is next to none. And this is what spurred the development of touch surgery. We looked at how could we present surgical operations into an interactive, three-dimensional, graphical way to the end user in an accessible and informative way, and also allow them to test themselves. And that's why we built Touch Surgery.
I was wondering if there were, when you said test themselves, meaning it's programmed to have glitches, right, in the surgery?
So initially, currently now, it's very much a straightforward step-by-step, and it doesn't give you an error.
Okay.
But we are building errors. The reason we're building errors is because, obviously, how best to deal with an error and how to get someone through an error to maximize patient outcomes and avoid complications is really important to us.
How did you – well, I guess how many procedures are on the program right now? What are the most commonly practiced?
So right now there are about 10 or 12. We're adding procedures on a regular basis now. We add at least one or two per month. We're growing slowly. And the most common right now is being laparoscopic cholecystectomy, which is a very common operation where you remove a gallbladder and patients who have had problems with gallstones. That's been very commonly downloaded. I know it's a big procedure with regards to general surgeons, and the downloads have been high within general surgical groups, but also it's been used by nurses and patients who are very interested in operations that they may be having.
My guest is John Namy. He is co-founder and CEO of Touch Surgery. We're talking about Touch Surgery, which is an application for smartphones, iPads, iPhones, I guess, to help somebody learn and practice surgical procedures. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Namy, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. I guess you want to make it snappy, though. He'll be with us for just another 10 minutes. What were the biggest challenges in developing this application? I mean, how do you make it realistic enough to make it? I'm not even sure how to ask the question in a way, but make it realistic enough to make it helpful.
Yeah. So essentially, you look at an operation, right? An operation entails much more than just a surgeon's hands. It's a surgeon's brain, and it's a decision-making ability. And so, to start off with, we really need to identify each decision-making point, each step. And to do this, we really need to talk to experts and get, you know, a formalized list of every part of an operation. Taking this further, we ourselves are surgeons, and we built the entire product. And so we built a 3D anatomy model and continue to therefore build each operation as per the steps. And it's very fortunate that within the team, we've got a fantastic 3D animator, Advik Gandhi, who is a surgeon. And so, therefore, he knows what surgery looks like and is able to build a realistic product.
And is there some day, do you ever get the sense that you're going to be able to create apps that are more three-dimensional?
We're working on that. We are working with a number of things. The current format it's available on the iPhone and the iPad. However, we are going to be multi-platform soon. And there are a number of ways that we're looking at this, one of which is getting into the Android market, as well as getting onto desktop PCs using three-dimensional interactive tools that are now becoming available in the market.
Kind of like the computer-assisted design that's out there now?
Yes, kind of like that. There are a number of other things that allow you, such as technology similar to the Xbox Kinect, where you're able to interact with a screen using motion.
Okay. And you said that patients were using it as well, and I was curious about what you're seeing as far as what people are using. What do you find them most interested in?
So the interesting thing is with patients, for a long time when we've talked to patients and tried to consent them for operative procedures, it's you often are left feeling as a physician and a surgeon, does my patient really understand what I'm going to do to them? Surgery is a very complicated process, and a while ago we looked at consent and informed consent procedures in surgery, and we looked at patients who are better informed, and patients who are better informed tend to be less anxious, and also are able to cooperate more with the surgeon and are much more engaged in the procedure, and so their satisfaction is higher. And so with patients, we found that using touch surgery as a means of educating them before their surgery allows them to become much more engaged in the operation. They are much more receptive. They better understand what's going to happen to them. And lots of surgeons are currently using this within, for some of the modules, within their clinical rooms, where they're able to send a patient out and say, have a look at this on the iPad, and you can better understand what I'm going to do with you if you're interested. And we're finding a lot of patients are.
Were there other surgical simulators out there already?
There are a number of simulators out there already. They tend to be hardware devices that are based in labs, and so they're less accessible. We really wanted to put this in people's pockets, in physicians' pockets, as a reference tool, as a reference guide. And so that's kind of how we differ, in that it's much more accessible, and it's in your pocket, it's on your iPad. You're able to use it as a reference tool. And other simulators tend to be much more hardware-based and driven and tend to be much bigger. And although they're very good, they're not as accessible as an iPhone or a smart device in your pocket.
Were there any concerns about doing it this way? Are there any concerns about how people might learn? I'm actually not talking about patients as much as I am the surgeons.
Yes.
Learning this way. Any concerns, any things that have had to be tweaked along the way? What about that?
I mean, so if your listeners, don't try this at home. It's probably the first thing that we suggest.
You say don't try it at home. Okay.
don't try it at home. It's definitely something that, we would advocate. There are currently lots of textbooks and lots of videos and things out there. People to learn from. This is an extension of it. It's making that interactive. It's built in a way where, with lots of academic studies that are underway, it's safe and content valid. It's built by experts. And it's just like writing a very high-end interactive surgical textbook. And so with regards to concerns, people are always going to say there's lots of other ways to do an operation, which we agree with. There are lots of ways this can account. This is one where we demonstrate one way, which has been validated by experts, built by experts, and quality assured by experts.
And as far as what it looks like, is it going to look more like a textbook illustration of somebody's gallbladder for, just to throw that one out there? Or is it going to be more like a photograph of somebody's gallbladder? How's it look?
Well, I advise firstly all your listeners to download it and have a look. It's much better than that. It's a very three-dimensional representation of the body, so it's very similar to what you would see during an operation. But again, it's a graphical representation of the human body, right? It's not a picture. It's a three-dimensional body that you're interacting with. That is a close. It's very anatomically correct. It's not exactly what you see in surgery because it's impossible to get the perfect tissue textures, but it's a close resemblance. So it's much more than just a photo, and it's much, much more than just an illustration.
And it's, the app is free for everyone now, right? What's your business model? How are you making money?
Right now, we're growing by working with academic institutions and medical devices and hospital groups. And it's really about getting all these stakeholders involved in surgical training and in patient education. Ultimately, we know that building an effective business model is going to allow our business to grow. We're currently in New York as part of Blueprint Health, which is an accelerator program that is helping us do that. And we're working with a number of stakeholders, looking at the right business model.
Okay.
Our primary objective, however, was to build something that would be really valuable to surgeons and also to physicians and patients and nurses. And that's been our primary objective today. We're now aligning ourselves with the best business model for this.
Well, needless to say, we'll have a link for our listeners, WOSU.org/allsides. For now, I want to thank John Namy for joining us. He's co-founder and CEO of Touch Surgery. Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you very much, John. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Coming up, we're going to be talking about ADHD and how grandparents can help. Yay. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us. And the WOSU Public Media Member Card Benefit of the Month for March is Chamber Music Columbus. Enjoy 2-for-1 admission for tickets purchased in March for the April 20th performance of the Keller Quartet. Support 89.7 NPR News at the $85 level or more and receive your member card. Just visit WOSU.org. And thanks for your support. Cloudy skies for today, a high near 36. We'll see a few snow flurries. Clouds for tonight and a low of 27 degrees. Cloudy skies and some flurries for Thursday, a high of 38. Support comes from Ohio Northern University, investing in the success of its students by offering more than $58 million in scholarships and financial aid annually. Nationally ranked academics and a 92% job placement rate are hallmarks of an ONU education. Explore Pharmacy Day is March 16th, onu.edu. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. When a child is diagnosed with ADD or ADHD, it can be stressful for the whole family. The parents can feel overwhelmed with questions about how to get the best care and education for their child. Other adults in the family, such as grandparents, also want to learn all they can about the ADHD diagnosis, or maybe they don't, but they should. But like with so many health questions, answers are not always easy to find, and some are contradictory, and they're definitely not always aimed at people outside of the immediate family. Joining us now to answer some of those questions about ADHD is Judy Kirzner. She is the author of a new guidebook called Help, My Grandchild Has ADHD. Welcome to the show, Judy.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So listeners out there, if you have a question about if you're an extended family member of someone who has ADHD, ADD, you want to talk about it, have any questions for Judy Kirzner, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So why did grandparents need a specific guidebook like this, in your opinion?
First of all, I couldn't find one out there for grandparents, and I am a grandparent now. But when I was an instructional specialist for more than 20 years, I realized that when parents were coming to talk to me, they didn't want to just talk about the school day. They started to confide in me about the problems they were having with relationships in the family, how it was impacting everything in their lives. And they also brought up the situation that grandparents were sometimes part of the problem.
In what way?
Grandparents were challenging them and didn't know everything they could know about ADHD. They tended to challenge the medications. They would say that it wasn't necessary and you shouldn't do it. And I just read in Ladies' Home Journal that this is going to do some damage. Or they would blame.
That's just a hypothetical. We're
right,
not nothing against
right,
Ladies'
no,
Home Journal.
No,
right,
absolutely.
Right, okay.
Or they would complain about the spouse. Well, what do you expect? He's just like his father. You know, that's why he's such a wild man. Or they would say, well, you never discipline. That's why. This is just convenient. In our day, we didn't have this.
And did you find yourself as a grandparent saying or thinking those things?
Not necessarily about that. My grandkids aren't old enough yet to have a diagnosis. But I know I tend to butt in. I think that I know more than they do because I've done it before. So not so much with my own yet.
So it's your expertise in the field then, and you're the people that came to you for help.
Exactly.
That brought you to this guidebook. It's interesting. It starts pretty basic. I like to just go through the contents. What does it look like? What does what look like? ADHD?
Yes. Yes. And I note in there that I don't do a very scientific brain dissection kind of a book. It's very straightforward and not at all complicated or technical.
It starts with a quote, the first chapter, just about the time a woman thinks her work is done, she becomes a grandmother. And really, this is part of a larger story about grandparents stepping in and helping out with families
right.
more than maybe this past generation did.
That's correct. This is written more, though, for the grandparent who lives in a different household. And not
more
so
traditional.
Much, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much for the one who's raising her grandchild.
So people who have kids with ADHD, they deal with their friends who are asking those same questions. Friends and other people like, why are you medicating them? You know, on and on and on. Mm-hmm. It's different when it's coming from a parent.
Well, you want there's that old wanting to please your parent thing. And if your mother, the mother of the adult child, calls up and starts putting doubts in your head, a lot of times parents of ADHD children already have doubts about their parenting, and they wonder if they did something wrong, or maybe it was their fault, or maybe they're not strict enough. So when your mother is telling you that you're not doing something right to the adult mother, it's damaging. It really brings your confidence down.
In chapter 3, it's entitled Stress Reducer or Stress Producer, and you're asking grandparents to ask themselves some questions.
That's right. And hopefully that is not done to make them feel bad about what they're doing. It's a guide place. It's a place to look at where you could make some improvements. That's what this is about. This is about learning what these families are going through and then using that information so that you know how to be supportive.
There are two of those great kind of questionnaires where you zero, one, or two
mm-hmm.
on stress producer, doubt that ADHD is real. Is that a common
very
problem?
Common, very common. I don't write about the school day, but I've had teachers doubt that ADHD is real. They say it's something that never existed before. It's a convenience. Let's medicate so that it's easier to run the classroom. Let's medicate so that our kids listen and do what we say. Definitely.
And then criticizing parents, how they handle child rearing, sometimes, often, never. Again, you're going to count up all these numbers at the end of the stress producer question.
That's right.
Questionnaire, and you'll find out whether you are a horror.
Hopefully not.
Somewhat, disengaged to a certain extent. Some grandparents probably do disengage.
They do.
They don't want to be around the kid.
Well, sometimes, unfortunately, they didn't get what they bargained for. And they go to the bridge club and their friends are bragging about grandchildren's grades and they can't do that. So they do avoid
talking about them at all. My guest is Judy Kirzner. She's the author of Help, My Grandchild Has ADHD. Are you a grandparent out there whose grandchild has been diagnosed with ADHD or ADD? Give us a call. Tell us how you manage it. 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page, post your comment there or your question if you have one for Judy Kirzner. If you're a parent who is struggling to deal with your parents about your child who's been diagnosed with ADHD, give us a call as well. Judy might have some advice for you, too. 614-292-8513. The impact on the family is chapter four. Mm-hmm. And that the point there is that this is not an isolated situation.
Not at all.
It affects not only the parents, but the parents' relationships, like you said, going to the bridge club, mm-hmm. and the siblings.
The siblings suffer quite often when they have a brother or sister with ADHD. Sometimes they feel like they're ignored. Sometimes they're jealous because so much of the family's income and attention goes to that child with ADHD. Tutoring's expensive. Schooling can be expensive. Technology can be expensive. And the sibling might feel, you know, my brother or sister gets everything. My parents just expect me to do well, to be good, and to say that's okay.
And is that also, once again, a function of the fact that with something like a diagnosis, like this kind of a condition, it's not, you can't really see it. And that's for all intents and purposes, the person generally acts pretty normal.
That's true. And that, and in fact, a lot of my research for the book was by doing surveys online. And I had people say that, you know, if my child had a disability that was visible, I would get some sympathy or empathy rather than stares and dirty looks when we're out in public and my child acts crazy or wild and not like other children. So
it sounds a lot like when I'm talking to people who have children who are autistic. Mm-hmm. Certainly completely different diagnoses, mm-hmm. of course, mm-hmm. but that still, it you can't see it.
Right, right.
So it's more difficult to understand it.
Correct. The and you were asking about the other family members.
Yeah.
I think that what I want grandparents to know is how this is impacting the relationships in the family, not just the grandmother, mother, child, but also the marriage. If they knew more about the conflicts that these parents were having, they might be more sympathetic and more supportive and more helpful.
614-292-8513. If you want to give a call, talk with Judy Kirzner, author of Help, My Grandchild Has ADHD. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Money strain, you mentioned it. I mean, there's reasons why the marriage suffers. It's not just because their kid drives them nuts sometimes, but there's real problems.
Well, one thing is there's such an inordinate amount of time spent parenting this child that there's so much less time for being a couple or for me time for the mother. A lot of times they feel like there's not a fair division of labor. It feels like one parent is doing so much more than the other parent. A lot of times they don't even agree on the diagnosis, or dad will say, oh, you're just too easy on him. If you were just stricter with him, you know, like the grandmother saying, then maybe he would perform better. He knows you're going to help him. So of course he doesn't do the work. That way he knows you'll do it with him. So those things all impact. And if grandparents were sensitive to what was happening in the marriage, I think they could be very supportive.
David in Columbus, you're on the air with Judy Kirzner, the author of Help, My Grandchild Has ADHD. Welcome to the show, David.
Hi. My grandson was going through that ADHD thing, and one of my daughters took my grandson with, you know, the help of my other daughter, to help my other daughter to keep the balance. And what happened was I found that with good, solid structure, she used to be in the military, so she was very, you know, structured. Everything was structured, mm-hmm. consistent. Every day, right after school, you come in and do the homework. You come in and get the work done. And he would do that every day. And it was just consistent. She and her husband don't have any children, so it was perfect for that kind of a
See. So your daughter brought her child to her sister where she thought he was going to get more structured environment.
Exactly.
I see. Okay. And yeah. That's an interesting component of the whole thing. I mean, it does require a lot of structure. A lot of kids, they need to know what's coming next. What am I doing next? What's the plan?
Right. That's the big thing that that I'm seeing today. A lot of these children don't have any structure. That, you know, we got too much sitting down playing the video games, you know, instant on, instant mm-hmm. off. Mm-hmm. Everything, there is no consistency in the family structure.
And if you have something like ADHD, it just exacerbates it. David, thanks for your call.
Yes, ma'am.
Take care. Interesting idea of it. So I imagine that's another grandparent thing as well. You just let them watch that, play that video game too much.
That's right. ADHD is not caused by video games. It's not caused by too much television. It's not caused by too much sugar. It's not caused by poor parenting. But I do agree that when structure is provided for the ADHD child, that's wonderful. They really, really thrive with the structure, and he is certainly right about that. It is not going to make it go away. It will definitely help improve the situation.
You write about family gatherings where maybe the ADHD kid's the one always crying in the photograph, doesn't like all the running around, doesn't necessarily want to do or play with the cousins kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. What about family gatherings?
Well, the first thing about the family gatherings is that we have that sibling rivalry rearing up again. All the adult siblings appear at grandma's house, and they want their children to look stellar. They want them to be the stars, to behave, and so forth. And I suggest to grandparents that if they do want a nice family gathering, not perfect, but a nice one, they have to plan ahead. They have to shorten the guest list. They have to provide as much structure as they can. Let those parents keep their regular rules and not do away with all the schedules that these ADHD children thrive on. They need to put away their breakables so that the kids are not worried about, or the parents aren't hovering and the grandparents aren't hovering, that they're going to worry that they're going to break one of their lovely Christmas ornaments or something like that. There are preparations. Timeouts, not punishment timeouts. Timeouts to do something constructive and fun away from the group so that you're not feeling like it's a punishment to go to a quiet place and get yourself together again.
Mm-hmm. From Thomas on Facebook, he says, when you said that grandparents say that ADHD wasn't around when they were parents, is that true or was it just diagnosed as something else? Or I'll add to that, Thomas, not diagnosed at all.
Not diagnosed at all. It's officially diagnosed and becomes part of the literature in the 70s. Formally with the Americans with Disabilities Act and so forth. It is part of it. So we didn't have a name for it then. I knew some children in my own class that were always getting moved down to the lower class because they didn't behave right. But it was always there. We didn't invent it.
My guest once again, Judy Kirzner, author of Help, My Grandchild Has ADHD. The social impact of ADHD, that's something that's often, once again, it's not academic, so it's thought of as not as important. Mm. But it's you write about how they're very closely intertwined.
They are. Some of the symptoms of ADHD cause the social problems. The impulsivity, will let an ADHD child say things that he shouldn't say, just, you know, in the head, out the mouth. They have a lot of social problems because they don't know the art of conversation. They don't listen and wait for the other person to speak. They interrupt. They say so many things they shouldn't say. They also have a problem with the language where they don't understand sarcasm and they don't read body language, so that when the teacher's getting angry or the grandparent's getting angry, they don't see it. Whereas another child sees that change in body where this, the face, you know, the eyebrows raise, or you get that line in your forehead, or the other kids, or you cross your arms, the other children know, stop now. These children don't see the signs and get into so much social trouble.
Again, that impulsivity just is taking control.
Exactly.
Grandparents, what kind of bonds can they sow with children that they may not see every single day, that may be frustrating to try to cope with? They can't take them out and take them on the little outings they do with maybe other of their grandchildren. What can they do?
First of all, I think remember that these are children who have ADHD. They are not just ADHD. Look for their qualities. Love them unconditionally. There's so much research that shows that if a child has one significant adult in his or her life who believes in his success, who believes he can do things, who believes that everything's going to be okay, there is going to be success, that child will be so much more resilient and so much more successful.
I would imagine it's helpful for people to know how many people who have ADHD who are very famous and very successful.
Ah, well, there are lists and lists of famous people, and not just the celebrities like Robin Williams, who looks like and acts like he's got the ADHD, but famous entrepreneurs. And one story is with Walt Disney, where his teachers told him, or he was fired from a job, I believe, because they thought he was not creative enough. Walt Disney. There are lists and lists of famous people. And I'm hopeful that the grandparents will read that, be encouraged by the names they see on the list, and then share that with the grandchildren so that they know they do have other people with the same problem and they can achieve.
Judy Kirzner is a national board certified teacher, exceptional needs specialist with more than 25 years of classroom experience in both public and private schools. She is a consultant on technology for learning disabled students and has been a lecturer and advisor on the best colleges for ADHD students. She's also the author of Help, My Grandchild Has ADHD. Judy Kirzner, thanks for joining us today. Really appreciate
it. Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Oh, coming up, we're going to try to help people be better informed as patients and help you understand what you might want to know more about your treatments, your medications, and so forth. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. This year marks her 20th anniversary on the court, and she turns 80. Our guest, Jeffrey Toobin, profiles her in The New Yorker. He says she may look frail and ready to retire,
but she is tough as nails. She works out regularly, and she is not leaving imminently.
Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And Thursday night, the Tenors visit the WOSU-TV studios to discuss their dazzling new show. Enjoy music from their newly released album, Lead With Your Heart. The show combines classic songs, modern tunes, and world music. Watch the Tenors Lead With Your Heart. It's Thursday night at 8 on WOSU-TV. Clouds for today, a high of 36. Cloudy skies tonight and a low of 27 degrees. A chance of flurries Thursday, a high of 38. Support comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra. Tony Award-winning singer Debbie Gervaud and the CJO perform a night of classic show tunes with a jazzy twist in the program. Big Band on Broadway, Thursday, March 14th through Sunday the 17th at the Southern Theater. Details and tickets at jazzartsgroup.org. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. It's Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Medical research is supposed to help us improve how we manage our health and our illnesses. But some health practitioners, you know, nurses and doctors and so forth, tend to go along with the way things always have been done. And most patients tend to do the same thing or don't question it. In a recent national survey of more than 1,000 registered nurses, Bernadette Melnick, she's the dean of the OSU College of Nursing, the associate VP for health promotion and chief wellness officer at Ohio State. She learned through that survey that it starts that it starts with resistance to change at the top. Bernadette Melnick is back today to talk about that and how it relates to you, the patient. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Anne. Happy to be here.
When we talk, when we talk about that, it seems like, well, of course they should be following and doing the latest thing. You know, we were talking about how to treat infections like ear infections, and the knee-jerk reaction is antibiotics. Is that what you're talking about?
You betcha. And there are so many practices that are being done in healthcare based on that's what we learned 10 or 20 years ago in nursing college, medical college, and people persist in doing those things despite the fact that we have great evidence from well-done studies to guide us to do things differently.
How is it a part? Is the problem the way the evidence of the new studies on how to do things is introduced to the medical field?
We have a saying that's actually supported by evidence that it takes about 17 years on average to take findings from rigorous research and get them applied to the bedside, to the care of patients. There are multiple reasons for this. One is the way that students are continually taught in programs throughout the country. Many programs are teaching students the rigorous process of how to do research instead of how do I take an evidence-based approach to care? How do I do quick searches for the best evidence? How do I quickly, critically appraise the evidence that I find? And then how do I remove the barriers that exist in healthcare systems that help me make practice changes quickly based on the best evidence?
Talking to Bernadette Melnick, she is the Dean of the College of Nursing, Associate Vice President for Health Promotion, and Chief Wellness Officer at Ohio State University. We're talking about a survey that she did a couple years, well, actually last year, of nurses. Pretty much the first contact a lot of us have at the doctor's office, in the hospital, wherever. But it's not to dump on nurses. You find that this is throughout the healthcare industry.
Absolutely. I have done a lot of healthcare consulting throughout the United States, working with healthcare systems on how to improve quality of care, how to improve safety of care, and patient outcomes through evidence-based practice. I find that nurses, as well as other healthcare providers, they do want to deliver the best and highest quality care to their patients, but there are multiple barriers in healthcare systems that prevent them from implementing evidence-based practice.
Because somebody might come fresh out of nursing school and know the best practice, but they've got a boss to answer to.
That's exactly right. And leaders within healthcare systems, including managers, have to walk the talk. A magnet, if you have heard of the magnet recognition program that indicates the highest quality of care provided by nursing staff, one of their key elements to get magnet is evidence-based, providing evidence-based health care. But there are less than 5% of hospitals that are recognized by magnet nationally. Our medical center at Ohio State is a magnet-designated institution, and I think people need to look for that credential as they're trying to decide where they go. Just like I think people need to be asking their primary care providers, physicians and nurse practitioners, what they're basing their recommendations on. Is it on the best evidence, or is that the way we just do it here?
My guest once again, Bernadette Melnick, we're talking about best practices and how to make sure that you're availing yourself of them as a patient or maybe as a healthcare giver. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, if you have a question or comment for Dr. Melnick. She's Dean of the College of Nursing, Associate Vice President for Health Promotion, and Chief Wellness Officer at Ohio State. I don't even know how you do all this stuff, but that'll be another show for another day, I think. So it's nerve-wracking, though. I mean, it's people are still struggling with the idea of getting a second opinion about pretty serious things. And so is there a script out there somewhere? I mean, that would be great if you had a script for people where they could literally walk in and say, tell them what to say. Oh, you do?
We do.
Well, I really didn't know about this, folks.
Yes, I have what's called an Ask for EBP, for evidence-based practice card. So A is to ask your provider for the evidence behind the screening or treatments he or she is recommending. S is for stop your provider if you don't understand your care, and ask for evidence-based explanations in a language you can understand. K is keep asking questions until you are satisfied with the answers. You know, people trust their providers, so they often don't feel comfortable asking questions. We have to keep asking until we feel good about the answers we're receiving. E, the other E in EBP, stands for engage in healthcare decisions with your provider. B, for be sure to seek out care as well as information research sources that are evidence-based and reliable. And P, persist if you're not satisfied with your care or their answers to your questions. People have to be assertive with their care. I don't know if you're aware, Anne, but 1 out of 10 people who enter a hospital system have a medical error happen to them. And if you are 1 in 10 that you have a medical error happen to you, 5 to 15% of you will either die or have permanent disability. And many of those errors are made due to non-evidence-based healthcare.
One evidence-based model has been the idea of the checklist. In a hospital, it's been proven without a doubt that if you have a checklist, particularly in a hospital, and you just check off, and these things might be rote stuff that you've done every day for the last 25 years as a nurse, but if you have a checklist, it improves the odds and it lowers that 1 out of 10, or you know, it changes that ratio a lot.
That's right.
Why do health professionals resist it?
It's, again, it's this level of comfort in doing things the way we've always done them. It's laborious processes within systems that don't allow folks to move once good new evidence comes out to get a practice changed. It has to go through multiple layers often of bureaucracy to get something changed. I could literally sit and talk with you at least 8 hours of example after example of all the things that are happening across the country in our healthcare system that aren't using the best evidence-based practices.
Is this partly because it's the geometric progression of knowledge, too? It's kind of overwhelming. For many, many years, for many generations, health givers, healthcare providers, the old way was the best old way, and that's what they knew. And research has exploded, although it's kind of tapered off in just a last couple recent years. The bottom line is the research exploding, the amount of knowledge we have is exploding. How do you keep up with it? Even if you're a nurse, even if you're doing continuing education and all that kind of stuff.
Well,
evidence, I'm sympathetic to them a little bit.
I totally understand. And you're absolutely right. There's an overwhelming amount of evidence coming out every day and being published. However, when we teach evidence-based practice, we teach this as a problem-solving approach.
It's a process.
The way we deliver care. So there is a 7-step process that we teach clinicians how to follow that can streamline their ways to find the best evidence, to critically appraise it, and then how to best change practice based on that evidence.
I really liked it when I was talking to my nurse practitioner a couple weeks ago, and we're chatting about something, and she says, you know what, I'm going to go check that out. And she jumped up, she ran, she looked up something, she came back, here's what they know. I'm going to check on, you know, and she does that very, is that what you're kind of talking about? Is, wait a minute, I'm going to check that out.
So absolutely. Let me give you an example of that. So I was consulting with a hospital system in Anchorage, Alaska recently, and I was making rounds and talking with clinicians, and a clinician, a nurse actually said to me, you're never going to believe what an order was just written for, sugar paste for a pressure ulcer. And she said, I've never encountered this before. And she went to the provider who wrote that order and said, what's the evidence behind sugar paste? And the provider said, oh, I've used that for 30 years. It works great. Well, because she was an evidence-based healthcare provider, she asked a great clinical question about this. She searched for the evidence. She came back with a systematic review of randomized controlled studies and said, look, the evidence does not support that this is the best treatment.
But does it tick off the doctor?
I think most people, professionals, are receptive to, again, data, evidence. Evidence is very powerful, especially if it's high-quality evidence and the studies were conducted well. But I find, again, Anne, there are so many clinicians who are still hesitant to ask the questions. So many patients who are hesitant to ask the questions. I almost lost my youngest daughter in Australia about 9 years ago due to a ruptured appendix and non-evidence-based healthcare. And if I, as a nurse practitioner, did not push and advocate and ask the questions as rigorously as I did, I truly am convinced my daughter would have died. But most people, without my medical background, wouldn't have probably known what key questions to ask or felt comfortable to do that. So I'm here today to, again, encourage the public to ask.
You don't have to be an expert to ask. You just have to start asking the basic questions. That's what I do for a living. Nadia in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi. Welcome. You're on the air.
Okay. My name is Maria Nathan-Meyer. I'm a cardiac anesthesiologist, and I really appreciate that you brought this conversation to the topic. So the point I want to make is that it's absolutely important to realize that we are against this general concept of introducing protocolized medicine. Everything has to be in protocol. If the blood pressure is up, you give this. If the blood pressure is down, you give that. And this is done for reimbursement purposes and to make the job of hospital administrators easy. It gives very little room for imagination for the physician who's practicing. And I've traditionally what I've done is I did seek evidence, and evidence is a very confusing thing to seek sometimes. There's a contradictory evidence. Often evidence that's been carved in people's minds is not necessarily brought out from the best studies. And it's easy to go back, like you said, and to research and to find evidence for what actually works and what you want to introduce in this specific patient's care. The concept of individualized patient care is no longer there, even though this is a term that a lot of hospitals use for marketing. But they do not see this patient with a specific set of problems that are unique to this patient.
Okay.
And therefore, you know, the other thing is that when somebody seeks treatment, whereas it's important which hospital they're going to, but these management designations do not say it all. It finally is your physician and is your nurse who's going to deliver the best care for you. And people have to be asking questions, because really what has I've just every single day of my life as a cardiac anesthesiologist, I see a patient who comes with mitral stenosis. When you look what the books say or the evidence says, you have to keep the heart rate low. Whereas, you know, when you look at this specific patient, you might need to do something else.
Or uh-huh.
What is low? So
right.
It is, we have to get away from protocolized medicine that the administrators of hospitals are forcing, again,
okay.
as a way to limit reimbursement by insurance, you know, to
right.
enable reimbursement by insurance companies.
That's
so
an interesting,
again,
yeah.
Money.
Thank
yeah.
Nadia, thank you for bringing that up. That's an interesting idea that we often forget. And Nadia, thanks for that call. Right now, when it comes to prescriptions, sometimes the problem is the insurance company saying, no, that's not how we do it.
You bet. I think what I want to add, though, here is part of evidence-based practice is a clinician's expertise and patient's preferences and values. So it's in addition to the studies, it's constantly being able to integrate a patient's preference, a clinician's expertise. Sometimes those factors will override what the studies are saying. I think Nadia made a lot of excellent points in the new healthcare reform bill. Providers, hospital systems will largely just be reimbursed for the best evidence for delivering care that is based on the best
evidence. And that's good. You like that.
That is important, but not at the total exclusion of the patient's preferences
okay.
and the clinician's expertise. All of those factors have to integrate together in delivering the best care.
How do you, this is not about medicine as much as it is about personalities, about behavior.
We're talking, just like we talked last time I was on the show, Anne, about behavior change. You
yeah.
know, getting people to engage in healthy lifestyle behavior change
right.
is what I call character building. It's tough. It doesn't happen easy, nor does getting a clinician to change their behavior. And a lot of times we forget we have to apply similar principles of behavior change with clinicians, just like we do with people, with patients. So it's a complex process. It truly is. And you have to build a culture, an environment that enables clinicians to use evidence-based practice. And that doesn't exist in many healthcare systems.
Well, I think starting the conversation today is very helpful, and I appreciate you joining us to do that.
Glad to do it.
It's Bernadette Melnick. She's Dean of the College of Nursing, Associate VP for Health Promotion, and Chief Wellness Officer at Ohio State University. Thanks to the All Sides crew, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producers Corinne Gleckler, Rachel Quimby, production assistants Karim Shaban, Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.